people, welcome to Have Guitar Wheel Travel, presented by Vintage Guitar Magazine, with your host, me, James Patrick Regan, otherwise known as Jimmy from the Deadlies, and today I'm speaking with singer-songwriter Adam Chaffins. In our conversation, Adam talks about his day job as a songwriter and how the songwriter sessions happen. Adam tells us about what life is like just outside of Nashville, and he describes his home studio and his guitar and bass collection. Adam takes us through his performance schedule and discusses playing at the Grand Ole Opry and playing stand-up bass for bluegrass bands and session work. Adam takes us through his musical upbringing, singing in worship bands in Kentucky, and then studying music in college. Finally, Adam tells us about his new album, Trailer Trash Double Wide, and working with Derek Wells and Brian Sutton. To find out more about Adam, you can go to his website, adamchaffins.com. That's AdamChaffins.com. Please subscribe, like, comment, share, and most of all, review this podcast. I really appreciate it. And please support Vintage Guitar Magazine and all the wonderful things they do for us guitar players and bass players, because they do so many wonderful things for us guitar players and bass players. If you want to support the show, we have a Patreon. It's patreon.com/HaveGuitarWillTravelPodcast. Here's my buddy Adam.
Hey there, Adam.
Hey, man. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing really well, man. Thanks for meeting with me today.
Well, absolutely. It's my pleasure. 100%. Are those all your instruments behind you there?
Yeah, it's some of them. A lot of the daily are drivers, I guess.
Right on.
Yeah.
And speaking of daily drivers, so what are you doing during the days? Like, what do you do during the week? Are you working in the studio?
I mean, all kinds of things, man. I mean, my day job, I guess, is a songwriter, with a publishing deal. So, I'm mostly writing here in the last little bit, and I produce stuff too. So, here the last little bit, I've just been getting a record out the door and, raising a little girl. So my days have been kind of occupied that way lately.
Yeah. Nelson. It's,
Oh, cool. Yeah. I appreciate it. Yeah.
And when you're doing songwriting, when you're in the songwriting sessions, are you the guy who comes up with the wild, crazy ideas?
You know, it depends who I'm writing with. You know, I think there's some rooms I'm in for that specifically. And then there's some people that like to write with me because they have those kind of quirky ideas that, they know I like to make sense of.
Yeah. And what does the session look like? Like, are you scheduled like, two or three times a day, like for a certain block?
I don't really do two a days. I think a lot of younger writers starting out kind of getting that, and there's a lot of other dudes that do that a lot too. There's a lot of people I write more than one song with in a day.
Okay.
But there's not necessarily, I do a lot of that. It's not common for me to do more than one write. Mostly, nowadays, mostly in the, afternoon times.
Okay. All right. And is that because you have a small child?
Yeah. I mean, Nashville kind of writing sessions usually start around, it used to be 10 when I first started out. It was definitely a hard 10, and then since COVID it's moved to a hard 11. Okay. Now it's like kind of assumed that it's 11, and a lot of older guys will be like, man, we used to start at 9. then it was 11. So for me, living out in the country a little bit, 11's pretty great, because I get to avoid, if I have a 10 o'clock ride, I have to leave my house at 9. If I have 11 o'clock ride, I have to leave my house at 10:25.
Okay. All right. So you're not that worried, but whereabouts are you?
I live just east of Nashville in Wilson County.
Okay. And is there a hard out for these sessions, or is it kind of?
I mean, I feel like, in my mind, it's like, if you can't get something in 3 to 4 hours, then it's probably not getting,
Yeah.
Or, sometimes somebody might have a hard out and you're like, all right, we'll get together and finish this later.
Yeah.
But usually it's, usually 11 and I'm done by 2:30.
Okay.
So some people 12:30 if you're lucky, or 1:00. But you know, I try to be back on the interstate before 3 o'clock.
All right, right on. How bad's traffic out there?
It's pretty bad these days, man. on a Sunday evening, I can get, you know, to Nashville, or Sunday morning early, you can get to Nashville in about 35 minutes. But rush hour traffic, man, it's 60 minutes for sure.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And it, when you're doing these sessions, is it at somebody's house? Is it like at a...
I mean, I write here, like this studio is still very much a work in progress.
Uh-huh.
But I do a lot of writing here.
Okay.
I would say I'm kind of split writing at home, and I write with my wife a lot, which is also convenient. So a lot of people come to us and write.
Right on.
And I'm pretty prone to like cooking lunch for people, so they like to come. Got a little cardinal setup, so a lot of folks like to come out here for the famous BLT. But I, you know, I'll write in town by my publisher's office or someone else's publisher's office, or I'll go to other studios or houses. Uh-huh. It's kind of a mixed bag of all the stuff, you know. You kind of, it's really funny. It's a gamut of like, you know, going into some of the fanciest publishing offices in all of music, and then going into some dude's musty garage and writing songs. It's the, you know, it's that's the beauty of it all, I suppose.
The charm. Yeah. And who arranges all these things?
I have a publisher that does it, and I do it myself, and other publishers do it. So there's a whole, and my wife has someone who books her calendar that puts me on those. So there's a whole team of people and me. But I mean, I feel like I've been doing this a while now that people kind of seek you out to write with you, or, you know, I'll seek out to write with certain people, and it kind of works more that way.
Sure. Sure. And how often are you playing out?
We really started touring, you know, I was out this weekend. We're playing the Grand Ole Opry this coming Friday.
Sure.
Got an Americana Fest thing, and looking at getting back to doing, you know, more road dates the end half of the year from October on. Doing kind of more traveling.
Yeah. And what are you going to be playing? Where are you going to be playing? What kind of venues?
You know, the whole gamut of stuff, honestly. Some festivals and just some clubs and different things. They're actually putting that all together now, so hopefully I'll be able to have some more solid proof of what's happening soon.
Yeah. And are you supporting somebody? Like, are you doing the open slot, or are you...
Not right now. Okay. No, I've done quite a bit of that. I've opened for a lot of people, but I haven't really done that this year.
Yeah. And you've been in other people's bands, correct?
Yeah, I've been in a lot of different bands. You know, mostly the band membership I've been a part of have been bluegrass bands,
uh-huh.
playing upright bass primarily.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, you know, I've toured with a lot of other artists and played with a lot of artists and done a lot of sessions for a lot of people. So I've kind of had a pretty diverse career, man. I've got to work in a wide array of genres, from rock to the biggest rock bands to the biggest pop acts to country to bluegrass, and, you know, all the way around it.
You're playing stand-up bass. That's got to be you pretty well in demand for stand-up bass?
Yeah, that kind of, when I moved to town, that kind of became the thing I was most known for.
Uh-huh.
And then I had some, like, you know, I wrote some songs at the beginning. And honestly, I moved to Nashville wanting to be a writer, not really knowing how to break into it. And at the time I moved here, man, Music Row was pretty, like, we were, it was one big foot into bro country when I moved to town. And this is really not something... I kind of, it's not my forte, I would say.
Uh-huh.
I've probably written some songs with some bro country people who, you know, I didn't really consider it a bro country moment, but
yeah.
When I moved to town, that was a lot more happening, and, you know, and I honestly was more wrapped into doing original music with bands,
mm-hmm.
trying to figure out my own thing and not really paying attention at all to Music Row. Like, I was more East Nashville has its own kind of scene, and nowadays I feel like it's all pretty
homogenized.
Yes, we're all just kind of together. Like, it's more of a universal thing. I feel like Music Row still has a lot of weight, but
yeah,
not in, you know, so does everybody else. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot more openness in that, but I felt like more aligned to that and kind of more of a fringy side of Americana, and identified more with that community. And I feel like country music, and honestly, I think the reality was I was maybe intimidated or afraid to that what I did wouldn't mesh with country or be accepted, which honestly has never been the case. As soon as I made relationships in country music, meeting like Frank Rogers,
yeah.
It was very open and accepting, like from the get go. Wow. Probably more so in a lot of ways, you know.
Yeah.
Like I have a song that's doing way better on country radio than it is Americana radio right now.
is that Lucky Me?
No, it's a song called King of Coal Dust County.
Okay, all right, yeah, that's a great song too.
Yeah.
And is bass your first instrument?
Because
there's a lot of guitars behind your ears.
Yeah, I would say that my voice is my first instrument. Okay. I've been way longer than I have anything else, and I feel like I just tried to do other stuff to accompany my voice more than I have anything else, and which, you know, led to me getting a kind of a music degree and performance on an instrument. But you know, starting out, I, you know, the first band I had when I was like 12, I knew a guitar player and a drummer, but I didn't know a bass player.
Okay.
So I played the bass and sang, and there was a praise and worship band at a church I didn't even go to that my cousin did, who left to go to college, and then they didn't have a bass player. So I ended up, you know, kind of doing that. And at that point, I was still very just, I'd only played in my bedroom as a kid. That was the first opportunity I ever had to play with other musicians in a sure. performance setting and learn how to communicate. And I learned there was a really great, you know, he was kind of a local legend guitar player who like put the praise band together, and another guy who played keys who had a background in jazz drums.
Oh wow.
So they could speak music, and I learned a lot from that. That was, you know, so, you know, doing that and then having little bands and stuff together, I've been playing music with other people for a really long time.
Sure, sure, sure. And where is it that you went to school for your degree?
I went to Morehead State University.
Where's that?
It's in Morehead, Kentucky.
Okay. Right on. Is that where you're from?
I'm from a town called Louisa.
Okay.
So Louisa's about an hour from Morehead.
Okay. And where in the great state of Kentucky? What part of the great state of Kentucky?
Far east. In the far, far east.
Okay.
Like my hometown, you know, is borders southeast West Virginia and is really close to the Ohio border, within, you know, a 30-minute drive
wow.
to the Ohio border. Definitely that tri-state area, you know, part of where I grew up, the southern part of West Virginia right there, Huntington, West Virginia, up in, you know, in that whole little region to Fort Gay, West Virginia, feels as much a part of like where I grew up or the home region. Growing up in a really small town, we didn't have a Walmart. So if you wanted to go... You wanted to go to the shopping mall or the movies or Walmart, you had to drive, you know, 30 minutes in either direction to find any of those things.
Okay.
So I feel part of that area too.
Did you need a Walmart?
I mean, if you needed anything, you know, there was no real...
There's no market.
There was not. There's a couple grocery stores, sure. but yeah, there was no record store, you yeah. know.
Any more record stores?
No, exactly. But, you know, as a kid, I loved going to the mall because there was multiple record stores in the mall and
they
Walmart.
Still existed?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I've been around for a minute, man.
It doesn't look like it. You have youthful good looks.
I appreciate it. No, man, I definitely, you know, grew up buying buying records from little record stores in the mall, and you know, buying CDs and physically holding thing, and like,
of course, yes,
on the radio and being like, I have that whole project, and then buying a record and liking two songs of it, and like, you know, program directing myself to like the rest of the record because I already spent $18 on it.
Yeah,
you know, that whole that the thing that I feel like the new generation of music listeners don't benefit from, honestly.
No,
I think personally, there's something really cool about having access. You know, going to college for music. If you wanted to learn a song, you'd really have to seek it out, you know, and it wasn't as hard. Like you could go download it probably, or I'd go to the library and have them order it for me. But nowadays it's like literally on your phone, you have access to every song that's ever been recorded. And if you don't, then it kind of doesn't exist. You know what I mean?
Not only the every song that ever existed, but many, many multiple versions of that song.
Exactly, yes.
By a lot of people you never wanted to hear them play that song.
I mean, and now, you know, if you wanted to transcribe a song, you know, you had to physically do it. You didn't have access, or you had to buy transcriptions from Mel Bay or something and, like, order it. But now it's like you can find 18 different transcriptions to every, you know, to every Charlie Parker solo that's ever. you can find it all nowadays. So I feel like that's why I think there's a lot of more kids doing it and at a higher level coming out, because it's easier to like just go straight to the source, which is really cool. It's going to make everything better. But I think, like, culturally speaking, man, we don't have a center marketplace or center gathering living room for culture as we used to, which
no, definitely not.
I think a bummer. Yeah,
it's a bummer. It's a bummer. So what year did you graduate, and what brought you to Nashville? What year did you come to Nashville? And what
I've been in Nashville for 16 years, man. And doing what I do now is what brought me here. You know,
it was always music for you. There was never anything else.
Yeah, man. As long as I remember, I've only wanted to make music. You know, I went to college for music just because I had some scholarship opportunities, and it was like the only thing that was ingrained in my head was you have to go to college. Like, you're a failure if you don't go to school for something. And I was like, well, I don't want to do anything but play music, so I guess I'm going to do that. And I'm like, I was talking to someone about this the other day. I was talking to my guitar player about it yesterday. It's like, I went to school for music, but I'm a professional musician. There's not a lot of people I know that can say they do what they went to college for.
Oh, no.
Did I need my degree to do what I do? No, but the knowledge that I gained from it was worth every moment I spent studying it in school, and I wouldn't trade that for anything.
Oh yeah, and just being able to complete something and
exactly, yeah, man, it's like a whole learning process, and being, you know, from kind of a nowhere town and growing up with the same people the whole time, you know, it's a very, you know, and even going to college in East Kentucky, it was still a more prominent university where people came from other places. So I got culture and still had some grounding to where I was from in it, but definitely an experience that set me up well to make a move to Nashville years later.
Yeah. And so why not Berkeley?
To be honest, I had opportunities to do stuff like that. I had some kind of scholarships to a bunch of different universities, and maybe I was just too naive, and I'd never been to the Northeast at all. I never had been on an airplane, like a commercial airplane, ever. So the idea of going to Berkeley seemed pretty far-fetched. Out of high school, before I went to Moorhead, I went to a school called Bellarmine University in Louisville, Kentucky. And I was a part of this Governor School for the Arts thing. And I was like one of the first people, I was like the first person from my high school that ever even auditioned for that thing or knew it existed. And I got in for classical voice.
Oh, right, which on.
Wasn't necessarily something I was into. It was just like, all right, man, you know, I got to get out of the holler somehow.
Yeah.
And here's an opportunity. And I had opportunities from that to have audition, like, first kind of like cattle call auditions with all these major universities, Berkeley being one of them.
Okay.
So I had lots of scholarship offers, but the school that I went to offered me a scholarship for singing, but they also had a recording music kind of program.
Yeah, of course.
And I really just used that because I was like, I just want to record. Yeah. And then getting there, it was like not all it was cracked up to be. And I think going there, and then I was taking like jazz piano lessons and some different other stuff and playing in ensembles. And I think I realized like I can figure out how to record music eventually, but I need to learn how to play it first. Like, I think being a better musician is going to benefit me more than learning how to use a compressor properly at this point. That's what I'll figure out.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it took, you know, years later before really getting into that. So I just, going to Moorhead was more of a, you know, institutionalized way of learning music.
Sure. And on this record, is this the first time you worked with Derek?
Yeah, it's the first time I worked with Derek Wells. Yeah. Yeah. It was a big part of me signing my deal. Actually, the meeting that I had when I got signed was Derek was in the room and he had a session to pop to, and he just went over and you know, I was kind of sitting in front of these guys, and he got up from his chair. He's like, I hate to run, but I did not think this meeting was going to last this long. He just came over to me, looked at everybody. He was like, please offer this guy a deal before I get back. Like, he has to have a deal before I want to come back from the session knowing that he's signed here.
Okay. Right on.
Which, you know, was the next thing, the first thing that kind of knocked it off for, I think, everybody else to be like, yeah, okay, we're all on the same page here.
And what was it like working with Brian Sutton?
Oh, man, Brian's like been, you know, a musical hero. One of the first shows I saw in Nashville, I used to chase Brian around everywhere. Like, I remember seeing him play in East Nashville at this little barbecue joint in a tent they had outside for like four people. And he was playing Telecaster. He was playing like old country songs on telly, you know? And then I saw him play with Tim O'Brien at the Station Inn. And then, you know, playing in bluegrass bands, I was kind of, you know, these are my peripheral festivals and stuff kind of going up. But yeah, to make this record, it was like, I think the sound in my head when I hear the acoustic guitar is Brian Sutton.
Oh, yeah.
So when it comes to like the music that I want to come across, and I wanted to make at least for once in my career, to make a record that was, having grown up being really loving Music Row made music, radio stuff, and having gone the route that I went, learning jazz and then going through bluegrass and a classical background-ish, I wanted to take those influences and do it in a setting that was, you know, a more modern Nashville recording session with my favorite players that I've had on all these records throughout the years, friends too.
Yeah.
So working with Sutton on that, man, was so cool. It's funny that you say lucky me, because I played the acoustic guitar on that song, and it was the part seemed like Brian was very big on like your touch is your tone, you know, your touch is your voice. Like, that's a whole part of it. And I was like, I don't know how to play this, how to do this song without playing the guitar, or like the melody and how I perform it is so attached to it.
Sure.
And you have to play the guitar. And he came in and was like, hey, I'll just track bass on this while we go through, and then you can just overdub it later. And I gave him that Hofner club bass right there. Some of these basses work. And I mean, his plan was so cool on it that it was like, no, that's staying on here, man. You know?
Right on. Because that's quite a funky riff, the guitar riff.
Yeah, and I think it, you know, there's so many different grooves and styles on this record, and that's what I wanted to showcase, that not everything in record has to sound the same all the way through, you know.
But luckily your tongue-in-cheek humor is pretty prevalent through the whole thing.
I hope so. I hope that people see it as that.
And so I see that Black Telly is a thin line. It's got to be a thin line.
Yeah, that's a Thinline Telecaster that Fender gifted. Actually, that was, I think they gave that to Britt. I probably played a bit more than she does, though.
And the Taylor next to that?
Yeah, that's a high-strung Taylor guitar.
Okay.
That's a bunch of sessions.
Yeah. And then the octave with the Bigsby. You needed a Bigsby on the
back. Yeah, the Bigsby's on it. Yeah. That
sounds like a pain in the ass.
Well, that's the thing. It's really fun, but if you're laying it down on something, you can get some really cool things you can't do, especially running through a pedal board and a bunch of cool effects. I've put it on records and ways that it just sounds like a tone, but yeah, you're retuning that thing after every sure.
and changing strings on it must be near impossible.
Yeah, I don't think those strings have been. I couldn't tell you when those strings got changed. I only change strings when my fingers start bleeding, or they're just so and like they have to be so rusty that I have residue on my hand. I hate changing guitar strings, and maybe this is from being an upright player and keeping a set on for 4+ years at a time, and never changing strings on, you know, electric basses.
Yeah.
So I kind of feel that way with the guitar. I have gotten a little into, especially with this project, changing strings on my D28 more often.
Uh-huh.
Because it's just easier to slide around. There's a lot of parts. I'm playing a lot of Brian Sutton licks.
Yeah.
So I'm slide around and like do things that sure. A fresh set of strings really benefit more than the dead tone of just strumming along.
Yeah. The D28's behind your head, correct?
Yeah, there's D28 right there.
Yeah, exactly. And you have bass six and the jazz bass.
Yeah, I've got a couple few-ish jazz basses. They're not on display here, oh. But the main rig I have now, and I play this P bass. It's the vintage, one of the vintage 2 series Fender P bass that I've used on the road a lot, because it has the 63 reissue.
Mm-hmm.
And the bass to the left of that is actually a Frankenstein 60s. 63 body with 63 pickups and a 68 neck.
Oh, right. We're right on.
It's the refin. But
it's affordable.
It's a thing that I'm cool to take around. It's not a museum piece. Like, I really love refins of that era because, yeah, they're not someone else, you know, made that decision to do what they did to it. That one I'm lucky. Like, it's truly. God knows what happened or where that bass came from, but it's the slinkiest bass. And what's funny is there's a J45 up there now, but when I got that bass, I just signed my publishing deal and I got an advance, and it was the first real record advance, you know, situation I'd ever received in my life. Not that it was an exuberant amount, but it was enough that my wife was like, hey, you know, you've always wanted a J45 and you got a deal to write songs. Like, you need to go buy you a J45.
Uh-huh.
So I went into Gruen's Guitar in Nashville, and I'd been searching for J45s for a minute, and I wanted an old one, and they're just hard to find the right one, man. For me, you can see them out there, but the one that's just that speaks to you, it's hard to find. If I can't find that, I'd rather just have something new and make it my own over time, which is what that J45 is.
Uh-huh.
But the which was gifted to me, by the way. I was walking out of Gruen's after a J45 search, and I look over and I see that P bass hanging on the wall, and I was like, well, that's interesting. And I went over, and I probably could have bought 2 J45s that day for buying that that bass. I definitely had to make a phone call. It's like, hey, I know we said a J45, but I found like my holy grail of electric basses. And after years of finding ones that I let get away,
yeah,
because like, oh, I'll find this later, and then, you know, you're like, man, I wish I would have got that. Or ones that I've had that I let go because I was like, oh, whatever. It was just that I was holding it in that moment, and I knew I had the money in the bank, and I was like, man, I've got this. This has to happen today. This coming home with me, and I'm so glad I did. I would love to clone it someday and have, you know, a different version of it, or maybe a maple neck version of it would be. Yeah. Really, but yeah, that's my the one for me right there.
Sure.
For
and what's right your now. Stand-up bass?
It's a Shin like factory bass that I got in college. It's probably about 20 years old now.
Okay.
And there's nothing super special to it. I purchased it in Cincinnati, Ohio in college. And then there was another luthier up there named Nick Lloyd who makes incredible, incredible award-winning, you know, orchestral, upright basses, but he loves folk music too, and he has a soft spot in his heart for plywood basses, which a lot of luthiers just kind of can look down on.
Sure.
And he did some upgrades then, and then over time, there's a luthier in Nashville named Randy Hunt who did a service where he took the neck off so I can get a bolt through it so I can fly with it, which I hardly ever take it apart anymore. Uh-huh. And I've had other basses with it, but honestly, like it sounds awesome plugged in to a stack, you know, an SVT rig.
Really? Right off.
Awesome. Sounds awesome through a Graze DI into a PA system. It doesn't feed back.
Yeah. What's the pickup?
I use a David Gage Realist.
Okay.
Piezo pickup, and David Gage is a great luthier, bass shop owner out of New York, and...
Is it attached to the bridge? Is that how it works?
It slides under the foot of the bridge.
Okay.
And a lot of people put it on the D and G string. I put it on the A and E string, though.
Okay.
And I've considered upgrading that. And I've used other pickup systems. I won't go. And there's other great ones out there.
Sure. That sure.
And I think some work better for certain instruments. Mm-hmm. But that one has resonated with that pickup. And apparently those pickups, like, they go bad over time. People are like, oh, you got to change them out. Huh. But that one is, like,
solid. No
complaints out of that thing. Yeah.
What about amps? What do you got for amps back there?
Man, I'm mostly using a Fender Bassman 100T. And I'll interchange between a 410 and a 15.
Okay.
And then if y'all want, I stack them all together. but I feel like with bass amps, man, they end up being like furniture.
Oh yeah. Speaking of SVT.
Yeah, exactly. So, and that's like the backline amp du jour for the electric bass. It seems on stages at festivals is the SVT.
Oh really? Wow.
You're a 610 or an 810.
Yeah.
Which is a great rig, but this bass is super versatile, and I have a couple different heads. I have a smaller head, and that seems to be the one I use most often. I don't like a lot of things that are that have a lot of tone built into them. I won't go into detail about other brands. There's tons of great ones, but it's got to have a tube on it for me.
Oh yeah,
you know, and this amp, the OG channel's got four knobs on it, and I don't need anything more than that on stage to dial an EQ to sound good between my tone knob, volume knob, and four knobs, and a master volume knob, you know. And the overdrive channel on these amps are incredible. Like the Super Bassman, I love those too. The overdrive channel, the distortion on that, like I'll use that on record. So I use this head, I'll use the 100T head a lot. The newer ones have the studio silent mode on the back, and you can just DI it directly out. Okay. So, and I'll split a DI between that, and Acme makes those Motown DIs that I like a lot too, and I'll put those a lot. And that's kind of been the rig I'm working on now. I've been in the process of building the studio to have more space. When I moved in with my wife, I had quite an assortment of things that I whittled down to have. And now I've converted this other space on our property to a studio, and I finally have room to acquire more things.
Do you have the money to acquire more new things?
Well, if your audience out there screams this new record enough, perhaps yeah. I will.
So. Okay. So your website, adamchaffins.com.
That's it, yeah, man.
And Chaffins is spelled?
Chaffins.
There you go. Very cool. Yeah. And you got two, so you just got the two dates on your calendar. And are there going to be more dates coming up? I mean,
yeah, we got some more. There's some more stuff coming up, kind of working towards that right now. And, you know, man, it's really been trying to get this record out and seeing how it plays. It's had a lot of luck on country radio, and uh-huh. been doing a lot of radio touring and playing the ground to go out. Touring as an artist right now, who's not, you know, getting started in that whole realm is more difficult than it's ever been.
It's expensive.
It's expensive, and it's also, I think, you know, people are having a hard time getting out to shows, even for bigger acts right now. It seems like across the board, and it's really just let me focus my attention on the ways I can get my music out.
Sure.
Talking to folks like you and playing, do a residency monthly in Nashville at Bobby's Idol Hour.
Right on.
Which has been really, really fun. And, you know, we did one of those Friday for the release show and, you know, kind of doing a lot of that and focusing on getting this record out and raising my baby girl over the summer.
Yeah.
So now we're focusing on, getting out there and seeing how the people like it and going down.
Are there any venues there where you're at right now?
In Nashville?
No, where you're living. Outside of Nashville?
No, not in this.
There's no pizza parlors or anything like that? Tap rooms?
No, man, we're out here. I like living somewhere where there's not music. Weird as it is, it's like I like going to... I feel like it's kind of nice to go into a restaurant that doesn't have... Like, most of us do. Oh, yeah. And not that, you know, there's great places for all that, but I feel like when I want to go see something, I'm committed. I know I'm going to do that.
Yeah, damn straight. Well, it's been wonderful talking to you, Adam. I appreciate your time.
You too. Where are you based out of?
I'm in Napa, California, Northern California.
You're in Napa? Oh, man, yeah, beautiful out there. Yeah, well, hope to get out there, man. We're getting some airplay on the West Coast. So
cool. When you come out here, I definitely want to shake your hand in person.
Yeah, man. Likewise. I appreciate you.
Yeah, right back at you. Thank you very much.
Thank Bye-bye. You, James.
See you too. Thanks for listening to Have Guitar Will Travel. You can catch up on all the things I'm doing at thedeadlies.com. And I'm on all the social media platforms as well. And please support Vintage Guitar and all the wonderful things they do, because they do many, many wonderful things for us guitar players. Thanks. Please subscribe. Please tell a friend. And I'll see you guys next week. Bye, guys.